Hello, everybody. This is Dr. Diana Wiley, and I am your host of Love, Lust, and Laughter. My guest, but we're doing a little bit of a flip today, but Dr. Jen Martin is a psychotherapist and a sexuality educator who did experience healing and transformation from sexual abuse through awakening to the sacred sexual mysteries of esoteric Christianity. And she hosts a weekly radio show called Eros and Evolution on Contact Talk Radio. And I'm going to be her guest next week, Tuesday. But for this show, Dr. Jen will be interviewing me, and we're going to talk about low sexual desire and cultural conditioning about sexuality, and we're going to open up the lines. So if any of you want to ask me a question or Dr. Jen, you can call 888-874-4888, and I would suggest that you call about 20 minutes after the hour, because we will have sort of set the themes by then. So welcome to the program, Dr. Jen. Hello.
Thank you, Dr. Diana. It's great to be here. It's been a number of years since I met you at the Seattle Institute for Sex Therapy Education and Research, but I started listening to your radio show back then, and I'm a big fan of it. It's a fantastic source of information.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you.
So I'm delighted to be here today and talk about this topic of low sexual desire. So to just get started, let's just talk about how prevalent is this really with women that you meet with?
Well, it's of course couples that I meet with, and also women, okay. And sometimes men individually, but mostly I see couples, and 1 in 3 married couples struggle with a gap in sexual desire. But in fact, mismatched desire is the number one problem discussed in sex therapists' offices. And so it's the number one problem, mismatched desire. And I don't know, have you encountered this as well in your work?
Absolutely, yes. Yeah, absolutely. So let's talk about some of the reasons for low desire.
Well, some of the reasons have to do with, usually it's the woman with a lower desire, but not always. But I would say 80% of the time, it's maybe 80 to 90% of the time, it's the woman with a lower desire. And sometimes she is overwhelmed with stress, anxiety, depression. She may have had sexual trauma or sexual abuse in her background. And she may have hormone imbalances. Or maybe there are side effects of medications. There can be fatigue. Did I mention depression? Probably not. Grief, negative body image. Let's see, what else? I would say unresolved issues from childhood, such as sexual abuse. And all of these things can really sap sexual desire. But the other causes are continuing arguments and feelings of anger between the partners. And so a lot of times I found in my almost 35 years of doing this work, I have to do psychotherapy before I can do sex therapy, because they're so angry with each other. They don't want to have sex.
Right. Can I share with you something that I read recently?
I'd love it.
About this topic?
Please.
Yes. So this is coming from Linda Savage, Dr. Linda Savage, Reclaiming Goddess Sexuality, The Power of the Feminine Way. And she says in chapter one, why women seek sex therapy. She talks about women seek sex therapy because they fear that there is something terribly wrong with their sexuality. They have lived so long under the shadow of the male model of woman as pleaser that very few of them have an independent view of their sexual selves. They may think that they have too little or too much desire based on what their partners have told them or what they've learned in their childhood and in adolescence. And then she goes on to just say, oh, this is the last sentence here, many women feel that they have lost their desire for sex because they do not respond in ways that satisfy their partners. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think there's a lot of truth to that. Women have often been brought up to please and to not ask for what they want or need, sexually speaking. And so they have trouble speaking up and asking for what they want. I just saw a couple where the woman was in tears for a lot of the session because it just broke her heart that she felt her spouse, her husband, was able to reassure her, but she felt that somehow she just couldn't satisfy him, and she didn't know why, and all of this. There was a fair amount of drama in the session.
What we're really talking about here is that this can cause a lot of distress.
A lot of distress, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And what's interesting, Dr. Jen, is that in most marriages, low-desire partners control the sexual relationship.
Mm-hmm.
This is a surprise to a lot of people. They determine the frequency of sex. And, I've found that too often there is the unspoken expectation, I don't have to satisfy your sexual needs, but I expect you to remain faithful to our marriage.
Yeah.
And I feel like this is an unfair arrangement. And mm-hmm. So I have suggestions for the lower sex drive person. And we'll get into that maybe now or...
Sure, let's talk about some of those suggestions, yeah.
All right, good, because there are lots of things that people can do, like just do it. And research suggests that for more than half the population, sexual desire doesn't just happen. Mm-hmm. That most have to be physically stimulated to feel desire. So people who think that they need to be in the mood to have sex might, in fact, need to have sex to get in the mood. And that's a big surprise for a lot of people. But
can we stop here? Can I just ask you, clarify the difference between sexual arousal and sexual desire?
Yeah. And that's a good question because the Masters and Johnson modeled their research in the late 50s, 60s, which was phenomenal. It pretty much created our field of sex therapy. Their model was desire, arousal, orgasm, and resolution. But mm-hmm. For so many, especially low desire women and a few men, arousal needs to come before desire.
Mm-hmm.
So that the woman needs to feel aroused and then the desire may kick in. And it often does. And I will give a homework assignment to my couples and to go ahead and have lots of fun sex, including intercourse, and many of the women will say when they come back, Oh, I didn't feel like it, but, you know, we got into it. I had an orgasm, and wow, what a difference it made.
Mm-hmm. So would you say that a desire has more of a mental, emotional side of it, and arousal is the physical aspect?
Well, that's an interesting. Yeah, I think that's a very interesting distinction. Yeah, I would say that's true.
Okay.
What we have in all aspects of our sexuality, we've got, especially for women, we have the emotional intimacy aspect, which is just so necessary. Mm-hmm. And the emotional intimacy, a woman has to feel safe and cared for, and her amygdala, that's the part of the brain that is the fear center, but also the feeling center, that amygdala part of the brain needs to take a nap for her to reach orgasm. But for the woman to reach orgasm, aside from, well, promoting the amygdala calming down and taking a nap, she needs to feel safe and protected and, you know, really good with her partner.
Mm-hmm. Now, I know we're talking about low desire, but I can imagine somebody thinking, okay, so with 50 Shades of Grey, there's fear in that sex. So you would think that the fear center in her brain is activated, but she's orgasming. So can you shed some light on that?
Well, so Jack Morin, who is no longer with us, but he had an erotic formula, and he wrote a book that was published about 30 years ago called The Erotic Mind. And his erotic formula went like this. Let me see if I can conjure it back up. So arousal has to do with excitement plus obstacles. And then we have a great sexual experience. But the obstacles could mean maybe, for instance, putting on a blindfold so that you can't see anything. That actually helps a number of people with the rest of the sensual stuff because they can feel it more if they don't have the visual, if they've eliminated the visual. But other obstacles, couples overcoming certain things can be a big erotic turn on. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it's all good.
Mm-hmm. You were sharing some ways that you coach or you counsel couples to overcome low desire.
Yes. So overcoming low desire. Thank you. So just do it is the first point. And then the next point, and this is particularly directed at women, and that is to dispense with a checklist because some low desire partners convince themselves that they cannot enjoy sex unless there's, the long list of conditions is met, paying the bills first, mm-hmm. et cetera, et cetera. So I encourage these women to make the relationship, the marriage, if they're married, a priority. And so, but dispensing with a checklist is hard for a lot of women, and it really requires being in the moment, mm-hmm. surrendering, and that's all helpful for orgasm as well.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you're not in the moment and surrendering, mm-hmm. and being in your body and out of your head, it's a big problem for the lower desire person.
Right. Actually, Because if you're not enjoying the experience, why would you even want to do it again, right? Or why would you be driven to seek it out? Right.
Well, so, occasionally you have women who have duty obligation as a motivation, and that often doesn't work very well long term.
Right. Yeah, I know in my, I come from Ireland, and that's I grew up with. Yeah, I grew up with the message that sex is your wifely duty. Now, thank God, when I became married, I met someone who did not believe that. And I wasn't plagued with that in my marriage, but that's a really difficult place. There are women today that still live with that belief. Would you agree?
Oh, yes, definitely. Duty obligation. And I think as we go along in the program, we'll maybe want to circle back to that because that's huge in terms of cultural conditioning. Mm-hmm. Another point, if you're the partner with a lower sex drive, is, and I think this is really important, and it sounds like it's not very much like a feminist, but it is, really. I think it's just a generous thing, and that is give your spouse a gift. Because in good relationships and good marriages, people give their spouses what they want, even if they don't always want the same thing. And,
Now you're saying that one particular partner, the person wanting sex should give a gift? Is that what you're saying? Or
no, the person with a lower desire should give a gift at times. A sexual gift.
I see. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Pleasure your partner to orgasm if that's what he or she wants, even if you're not in the mood for the same. And this has been good advice I've given to a number of my clients over the years. And because it's an act of love and caring, and I think it's completely appropriate within a marriage or a committed relationship.
Right, and I think that's the operative term there. Is that it's really coming from a place of love, not a place of martyrdom or sacrifice. Because if it's coming from that place, then the likelihood, especially if someone has had some kind of violation in their past, the likelihood that they'll disconnect physically and not even show up in their body, which I can't imagine that that's fully satisfying for a man if they're not. The woman is not actually fully present physically and is giving from that place?
Men want, ideally, they want their woman to be enthusiastic and also to initiate. There was a small survey of 500 men, and they asked the men what they would ideally want in a female lover. And they said a woman who was really enthusiastic and who could, on occasion, initiate sex. That's what men really want, the enthusiasm.
When I grew up in my strong Catholic family, and I'm not identified that strongly anymore, but it was not thought about that you would be the initiator. However, since that time, I've kind of reclaimed my spiritual connection, and I've received a lot of comfort from the Song of Songs in the Bible, because that is really talking about the woman as the initiator.
About that, because I'm not familiar. Maybe I don't know my Bible well enough, but tell us more.
Well, it's the erotic chapter in the Bible. It's incredibly erotic, and they're both talking about the two beloveds are talking about their desiring the body of each other, But the whole passage is really the strong voice in the passage is coming from the female side. And she really is the initiator, and the passion is completely received. That intention is completely received by the male side. So it's certainly not something that was shown to me when I was, you know, going through school, you know, nuns and so forth. But as an adult wanting to reclaim a spiritual basis for my sexuality, revisiting some books that weren't made known and really seeing, wow, there is really a strong connection here. And yes, a woman can be spiritual and also really desired by her partner by being the initiator. So I'm so glad you mentioned that survey.
Yes, and yeah. there's a shift. Even though we have here in the United States, and by the way, in 2001, after I gave a presentation at the World Congress for Sexology in Paris, I was on the radio in Ireland about three different times. And so this is 2001, and divorce had just been legalized. So we had people calling in wanting to make their second marriages or relationships better. Mm-hmm. And apparently there was this call screener, but apparently a priest called in and was very upset that I was on the air. Even though I was, of course, very professional and used all the correct terminology, but I was explicit because I don't know how to talk about sexuality unless it's explicit, right?
Absolutely, right.
By the way, Dr. Jen, have you seen the movie Brooklyn?
I have not. No.
Oh. Well, it's all about, it took place in the 50s, but it's all about a young woman who immigrated from Ireland to the United States and then went back, and it's just, put it on your to-do list.
Oh,
because it came out maybe 3 years ago. It's a beautiful movie, and I had an Irish-born client who had seen it and related to it completely.
Oh, I'm sure I will, too.
Thank you for
the suggestion.
Yes. So
on the topic of low desire, you know, I started off by saying women, and you corrected me. It can be either gender, but you would agree that it is the number one issue that women suffer from in terms of their sexuality and so forth. Would you agree?
Yes, it is.
Okay. And oftentimes, it's looked at as there's some kind of individual pathology going on. There's abuse and so forth in the background. But you've outlined that there's many, many reasons that could contribute to this. But since there are so many women that have this common issue going on, would you say that this actually has to do with our culture and the cultural messaging around women's sexuality in general?
I would say so, yes. In my practice, I see a lot of couples who come out of arranged marriages from India. Typically the husband has been hired by Microsoft here in Seattle, and they've had this arranged marriage, and then they have their parents back in India saying, where is our grandchild? But the woman, because sex education does not occur very much, I think it's beginning to improve slightly. I've been to India 3 times. I'm familiar with the culture. I presented a paper in Mumbai about 10 years ago at a sexuality conference. But with Indians, of course, the Kama Sutra from the 1500s is very sexual, but these days there isn't much sex education. So when I see Indian couples with arranged marriages where the woman sometimes turns up with vaginismus and the man turns up with erectile dysfunction, so I have to do sex education before I can even do sex therapy. So there are some cultural sorts of conditioning, or maybe just not knowing what to do, and that that can impact sexual desire for both.
Oh, okay. So, I see. But what would you say are the specific messages in that culture for women about their sexuality?
Well, I can't speak exactly, but but I can tell you what I've picked up from my clients and from the times I've been in India. But I haven't, those times I haven't done much interviewing, you know. But it has to do with not getting information from a mother, certainly not from a father. Sometimes from younger, older siblings, but not getting much information. So going into the arranged marriage with very little, if any, sex education. So there's sometimes fears around it. And then I have talked to some of these couples, and so here they are, virgins, on their wedding night. And if the woman has vaginismus, she penetration isn't even possible. And because the opening to the vagina contracts so much. But sometimes it is possible for penetration, and then for some, intercourse provides or ensues, and then is painful for her.
And the opportunity to have... Sorry, go ahead.
No. I just was going to say that that's not very good, you know, for the wedding night. You know, you have all these expectations. These high expectations. Well, finally we can do it. And by the way, this occurs a lot in the more conservative churches, too. And I know you do work around that.
Right. And, you know, if the culture is not very accepting of sexuality in general, who does one talk to at that point when something like that happens? It's encouraging for me to hear that you're getting clients like this that are, you know, being courageous to come and meet with a sex therapist like yourself.
And thank you, yes. However, a lot of them don't stay with the counseling.
Okay, why is that?
Because they're overwhelmed, even though I say, you know, I acknowledge their courage and all of that in the first session. I'm sure this is hard for you. You never expected to be talking about your sexuality with a stranger. This is very private information. I acknowledge all of their fears, but still, even though they really want to conceive a child and make their parents back in India happy, a lot of them don't stick with it.
Right. And I think, you know, I could say that where I came from, you know, not so much now, but that was the same kind of, that was the same fear, that same repressiveness around sexuality and so forth. But even in our American culture, would you say that there's an underlying fear of, I mean, we have a hypersexual culture, but then to have real conversations like you and I have is pretty uncommon. And I mean, would you say that there's a fear around sexual energy, and possibly this could be related to the, you know, the rape, the idea of the rape culture and so forth? What would you say about that?
Well, we're entering some complex areas, and I can say certain things, and they won't be true across the board. But there is, in some cultures, this is true, I know, in the Italian culture, because I spent a summer in Italy when I was very young, but I was sort of aware of what was going on. But it isn't just the Italian culture, it's other cultures, and it's the Madonna whore idea. So a man marries his woman, and then she bears his child or his children, and suddenly she's elevated to a Madonna status. And this does kind of is exacerbated, I think, by the Catholic Church. So she's then a Madonna. And so in Italy, it's very common, particularly among upper middle class and wealthy men, to take a mistress. And a lot of times the woman, the wife knows about it. But it kind of turns the other way and doesn't pay attention so much. But the man has trouble integrating that his woman, his wife, his partner, can be both a mother, a Madonna, and a whore, you know, sexually excitable and enthusiastic in the bedroom, that she can be both.
Yeah, and, you know, that sentiment was part of my upbringing, and actually my best friend was from the Philippines when I grew up. I actually went to grade school in British Columbia, and in the Philippines, the same thing. It's such a common thing for men to have mistresses, married men, and it's very Catholic culture. And it's part of my journey was to rediscover, okay, so is there a way to look at femininity in Christianity that encompasses more than just the mother archetype, but encompasses the lover archetype? And I think that some of the literature around Mary Magdalene has sought to bring that together, because when we just have a virgin feminine archetype as the epitome of purity, it gives us this unconscious message that if we are sexual, that there's something wrong with us. And I think that's kind of filtered down into our society. And I think it still is out there. Do you agree that there's a sense that, if I'm known to be a woman that likes sex, and I'm a sexual woman, that there's something not quite as pure about me as if I'm a woman that denies that aspect of myself?
I think it exists, but it depends on where you are in in the United States or in the world. I think that we've been coming along. I know, as a senior woman who has a very vital sexual life, and I'm so happy about it, and it's my fountain of youth. You know, I'm just proselytizing almost that having good sex as you age is so important. But there certainly are, for lots of people, taboos existing that older women should not be seen as sexual beings. And I had just a little side story. I had the advantage of having two great grandmothers, but one grandmother remained sexual until she was about 93. And my mother is still alive, almost 95, and she was sexual until she was almost 93. So, I have this legacy.
That's phenomenal. Now, what cultural background is your family from?
Well, we've been in the United States a long time. I mean, my father's side coming over on the Mayflower sort of thing.
Okay,
so,
I see.
It's very American, with sort of English background, and on my mother's side, Dutch. So, and the Dutch are very open too. So I had an advantage in coming out of these, back in my 20s, talking to my grandmother, and she was saying how much she enjoyed sex with her older lover. So I started getting interested really early on in aging and sexuality. Mm-hmm. And way back when I did my master's, so that was 30-plus years ago, I wrote a paper on aging and sexuality, and that my grandmother really influenced me. So all of that, I was very fortunate, I think.
That's wonderful. Yeah.
Yeah.
So do you also think that women get the message sometimes that unless someone desires me sexually or romantically, I'm not really a woman?
Well, I must be sexual to be lovable. Not so lovable. I think there are some women who feel that way. Probably these women need to have a little counseling, a little therapy.
Right.
I believe that a woman, when she's a whole woman, she can express her sexuality. I believe that our sexuality is at our core. And when we can express it easily, when we can get out of our heads and into our bodies, when we can surrender, then we can have the best sex possible. There are some women that maybe even unconsciously put up walls, that they don't want to be sexual or romantic. But I don't know that that's quite the question you were asking. Maybe you want to reframe it, Dr. Jen.
Well, let me just ask you about what we were just talking about, which was the influence of the rape culture and so forth, and the fear that gets translated to individuals from childhood, particularly to women. The fact that the reality that we are living in a patriarchal society and how that can influence low desire.
Okay. Well, it's very complicated, and I think if a woman feels that she is not living up to the standards of her religion or her family or whatever, she might see herself as a, and I put this in quote slut, and then that can unravel and make her sexuality less than pleasurable for her if she doesn't accept that she has feelings and desires. And yeah.
Now, on the other side of it, have you met with women in your practice who come in talking about distress about not having desire for their partner, but over time they reveal that they actually have a lot of desire, but it comes from self-stimulation and fantasies?
That's pretty common. I'll ask in my sessions with couples, I'll ask the woman, are you able to reach orgasm? And if they say yes, and then I'll ask how. And lots of women, especially women with some traumatic backgrounds or women who did not masturbate as teenagers, and maybe the neural pathways from the genitals to the brain were not laid down for orgasm. So they need vibrators in order to reach orgasm. The clitoris has 6,000 to 8,000 nerve fibers, and the penis has 4,000. But the nice thing about the clitoris is that the only function it has is for pleasure. God gave us a clit only for pleasure. And so isn't that a nice thing?
But yeah, women, that really does.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I read something that 100 years ago in Western culture, it was believed that women could not have orgasm. Is that accurate?
Well, yeah. And then they would go to doctors, and the doctors would call them hysterical. Mm-hmm. And then vibrated. The early models of vibrators were used where the doctors would vibrate the woman's clitoris, and she'd have an orgasm and the end of her hysteria. I mean, that sort of seems so bizarre, doesn't it, now when you think about it?
Right, right.
Women going
right.
to doctors to be stimulated with a vibrator.
Right.
I'm sure some of the doctors enjoyed the process. I'm not sure.
But so when we're talking, yeah, absolutely. So when we're talking about a woman who can reach orgasm through masturbation, but is not having that desire for her partner, I'm wondering if what could be going on there is the way sex is framed in their relationship, that it's more about performance or would you say it has to do with a difficulty allowing themselves to experience pleasure with another person? What would you say about that?
What I would say about that is that the woman needs to be really present and mindful and get out of her head and into her body and relate to her partner completely. And that's very hard. It's very hard for lots of women to surrender to the moment. And especially if she's had sexual trauma in her past. And that almost always needs therapy. I co-led two women's sexuality groups for 11 years when I was in California, and all of the women had had sexual trauma and abuse, and they didn't, all of them didn't stay for all 11 years, but many of them did stay for a number of years, and then they would graduate, and some of these women were able to get body work with a skilled body worker, and their sexual trauma, their sexual abuse, which was stored in the body, was revealed. I remember working with a woman in the group, Cheryl, who her father had raped her in the shed in the back of the house. From the time she was, I think, 10 until she was 13, and she was in the group, and then I had her as an individual client, and she remembered in individual therapy that her mother and her grandmother induced an abortion for her on the family bed, and it was her father's child. And so this was very traumatic, and I said to her, because when you have clients who have this much trauma, I said, Cheryl, because she was on a couch opposite my chair, I said, may I sit next to you and put my arm around you, and she said yes, and she just sobbed on my shoulder as this memory emerged. And but what women and men, for that matter, need when there are particularly painful sexual memories, they need a therapist who can be strong and can contain those memories.
Mm-hmm.
And she knew that about me, that I could hear it and that I could help her with it.
Mm-hmm.
So anybody listening, if you've had sexual abuse in your past, please get help, because it's very difficult to be whole and healthy and have a good sex life if you've had sexual trauma, sexual abuse, molestation in your past without getting help. And there is a website, asect.com, and that's AASEC.com, and that stands for American Association for Sex Educators, Counselors, and Teachers. And if you plug in wherever you are, they'll come up with some ASEC-certified sex therapist in your area. And when there's been sexual abuse, it just always needs professional help, in my experience. Wouldn't you agree, Dr. Jen? Because you've had sexual abuse in your past.
And it's not always visual memories that come back either. It can be stored in the body in a way that you don't get the visual part of it, but your body reacts and you know, and then it unravels over time. But absolutely, it's not a way to live, to be stuck in the past. There's so much. Sex has so much to offer and so much, it's such a wonderful aspect of life. To actually be able to experience it requires to move through those experiences.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm glad that you stopped there and talked about that. Now, in terms of the partner of someone who has gone through these experiences, what would you say to the partner?
Well, when I've done counseling with these women, I encourage them to bring the partner in for counseling.
Mm-hmm.
And for the partner, sometimes there's some issues around PTSD. So if the person that abused the woman had a beard, I will suggest to the husband, if he has a beard, to shave it off, because sometimes she can get triggered. It's like PTSD. She can get triggered from her partner looking similarly. But many partners don't quite understand, so that can be important to bring the partner in. Mm-hmm. And realize that this is not just something she's made up in her mind.
Mm-hmm.
That this has been... I honestly think that sexual abuse is one of the most deleterious things that can happen for a young person, with emotional scar tissue that just goes on and on and on. And... maybe, Dr. Jen, you want to share a little bit about, because you had some work to do around it, as I understand it.
Right. Well, yeah, there's so many different layers. It's hard to know where to start with that. But, my father was also leading a church. So there was a double aspect to that, and there's another part of this I think that's really important to talk about, and that is the trauma bond. that you can really live. I lived in denial all through, and it happened for years, the abuse. But I lived in denial until I was in my 20s that anything had even happened to me. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if you had said any contradictory thing against my parents, I would be the first to defend them, because I was the good child, and I loved being in that role. I, you know, it was more important for me to please and, frankly, be controlled than to have a mind of my own. I was the pliable one. It was my sister that was the rebel and became promiscuous. I was the asexual one, right?
Mm-hmm.
And just loved my parents and my abuser completely. And you know, I've come to the point where I feel compassion now. But a part of the healing process, and this was difficult for some people in my life that were very strongly identified with, religion, and that is, a part of my healing process is really to allow anger to emerge. And that was really difficult. I knew depression. I was very familiar with the experience of depression. But anger was a hard emotion for me to get to. But when it did come, anger was such, you know, I went from depression and self-loathing to anger. And the self-loathing kind of, disappeared to a certain extent, because the anger allowed me to realize the self-blame, it wasn't about me. It was about this person crossing a boundary that never should have been crossed. And, you know, when I started to feel the anger, luckily, I'm thankful that I never experimented with drugs or alcohol. And I think really that's because I had an internal sense that there was this higher power, not from external religion, but just always had this internal sense of that. And so I fueled my anger into the gym. And for a long time, though, I didn't want to leave that place of anger because it was a place of empowerment for me. Mm. But then, you know, after a period of working through that, it was time to, you know, let the anger go. Because I'd met my husband, and I really wanted to feel love. I really wanted to open my heart again. And, so I'm, it's been quite a healing process, but I'm thankful for having come through the other side. Yeah.
Well, you can bring a lot of your personal experiences to your coaching and to your sexuality education, and that's great.
Yes. Yeah. I'm not familiar with the current statistics right now. I've heard all different ones, but it is so prevalent, isn't it? It's just so prevalent.
Yeah, it is. It is.
Yeah.
And maybe we could go back to our theme, just as we wind up the program, about low sexual desire. So a 2015 study found that sex once a week was optimal, the optimal amount for maintaining marital happiness. And Canadian researchers analyzed data from three different studies, and they found that sex played an even bigger role than money in happiness.
And that's refreshing.
I know it. The difference in life satisfaction between couples who had sex once a week and those who had it less than once a month was bigger than the difference between those who had an annual income of $50,000 to $75,000 and those who had an annual income between $15,000 and $25,000.
Hmm.
So sex is pretty important in terms of marital happiness. More important than money.
That's great.
I know.
Yeah. And what are some of the other benefits of sex in general, would you say?
Oh, there are so many benefits. Maybe we'll talk about them when I do your show next week. But it's heart health. And in fact, the Brazilian in 2010, the Brazilian health minister suggested that people in Brazil have sex 5 times a week as a countermeasure to the epidemic of high blood pressure in the country. So, yes, and it's good for the immune system. It's good for pain. It's it goes on and on and on. Women who are perimenopausal, if they have satisfying sex, they're much happier. They have fewer hot flashes.
I know it's a little off topic and might be out of time, so we can save it. But would you say that you can get those same benefits if you're watching pornography as opposed to actually engaging with another human being?
Probably not. Mm-hmm. Yeah, continue this conversation next week on your show. Thank you, Dr. Jan. You've been just delightful. And next week I'll be back. And then I'll be on Dr. Jen's show. I'll give you her information on my review. Thank you, Jenny.
Anna.
Bye-bye.